thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the marketing and advertising podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Runicus.
And I'm Karen Harry. And in this episode, our special guest is startup guru, Fleur Emery. We'll be talking to Fleur about why she has decided to devote herself to helping female entrepreneurs get ahead. She describes herself as a Batman figure in the startup world, so we're really looking forward to hearing her own anecdotes about starting up in business. Welcome, Fleur, and thank you so much for joining us today. You've been a serial starter upper with the world's first porridge in a pot and a craft beer amongst the things you brought to market. So I'm sure we'll talk about those as we chat. But to start with, we were hoping you could tell us about your latest venture, Real Work, which you launched in June last year.
Hi, Karen. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Hi, Mark. So yeah, Real Work is a different business model for me. I sort of spent 15 years in industry starting food businesses, food and beverage. And was, yeah, sort of on the coalface, really, sort of in factories, getting production runs made, selling into retail, sampling endlessly outside train stations. That was kind of my life for a decade and a half. And then I stopped doing that when I had a kid, basically. I sort of, at the age of 42, I had a baby and lost my bite somewhat. And I went online and I sort of got into social media and some of the stuff which I'd kind of missed out on, really, when I was and I really liked it. And I started meeting women who were finding new ways to work. So freelancers and small business founders who weren't looking to change the world and raise 2 million quid and get huge exits. You know, they were just finding ways to live and work in a way that felt right for them around their sort of family and social obligations. And I was just connecting up with a lot of these women, really liked them, really felt part of that community. And then when the pandemic came, you know, I was stuck at home with my 5-year-old, who very eloquently informed me that I'm sometimes quite annoying. And she said it recently, actually, with the third lockdown came, when Boris was on the telly, she goes, Mum, I do love you, but you're quite annoying. And if that man says that we have to stay home together on our own, that is bad. So anyway, I had this kid. As you can hear, I love being a mum. It felt like an absolute gift. And I was meeting all these other women who were reproducing and starting different things, and they have bakeries in their garage and all this stuff, and I thought, oh my god, love them. And so I created a kind of online co-working space, a digital co-working space which operates in Slack. We're just starting work on creating an app at the moment. I'm doing a mini fundraiser. I can't help myself. We're going to do a bit of fundraising now, creating an app for it. But at the moment, it lives in Slack, and people have it on in the background on their computer when they're working, you know, on their own in their garage. We have all kinds of women, a 50-50 split between product businesses and service businesses. And it's a democracy. Everyone has something to learn. Everyone has something to teach. I'm learning a lot. I'm the kind of buoyant leader at the front, and I bring in outside speakers, and I've got a load of online courses that people can access. And it's, God, I love it. You can hear it, can't you? I mean, I made the product I wanted sort of by accident, and it's been a booming success. It's an absolute, I just wrote a column for Courier today on the novelty of starting a business that makes money. It just feels great. There's just these Stripe things come in all the time. Ding, 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 money in, hiring loads of women to help work with it. Feels great. Feels really good.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I love that. What you're saying really resonates with me as a woman in business as well, although less on the entrepreneurial side, but just finding working that matches your lifestyle. So part of that for you was obviously becoming a mother, and I'm sure that that really resonates with lots of women and lots of other lifestyle things as well, about finding that suits your lifestyle. What an amazing, it's not surprising to me, a huge success.
Thank you, that's kind.
So if I was, let's say I am a female entrepreneur, how do I tell skills and resources? How do I find my way to Real Work?
Okay, so we live on Instagram. YouTube is coming up. We have a super newsletter edited by a real worker, Sarah Arkell, who's a newsletter. Well, she loves newsletters. She's really good at them. So we have a newsletter you can sign up to. We have lots of free content, basically. So we give out masses. And then if you want to pay to join, you just follow various links through the Instagram page or through the YouTube page. And then once every 3 months, you can sign up. It's 115 quid. And you join for 3 months, like a term or a cohort. But if that's not for you, it's very, you know, very, there's lots of ways to connect with us and get the support that you need, even if you're not ready to pay to be in the Slack group. So come on over.
I can see Karen nodding on the Zoom. I think she'll be there soon. Our listeners know she's going on maternity leave soon. And there's been lots of people I've heard, not just because you've got time to think like Karen will have while she's on maternity leave, although you'll be super busy. She's nodding again. But I've noticed that lots of people who have been on furlough or now part furloughed have been thinking about alternative careers. And I want to come back to that later. But why did you think it was important to make these resources available just for women?
So I'd worked for 15 years in the food industry. And I mean, when I first started my first food business, Grasshopper Porridge, with my sister, we really didn't know what we were doing. We had no idea. We were absolutely green as grass. And we kind of had a surprise hit. There was a series of events which were accidents, really, that meant we happened to create a product at the right time that Waitrose happened to want. I mean, when we spoke earlier in the week, we were talking about pitching into retail. I'll tell you how we pitched into Waitrose. They phoned us and said, "Hello, we really like your porridge and we'd like to stock it in all of our stores." I mean, that's
a tough pitch.
Exactly. So, I mean, it was an anti-pitch. So it really was the early days when there weren't many independent brands around. And the food industry was really dominated by men in suits, and they were really baffled by us. The sort of child in me responded to that. You know, I didn't behave well. I was always fed up, and, you know, I just found the whole thing quite difficult to navigate, you know, fundraising. I just didn't know any of the lingo. I had a bit of imposter syndrome, if I'm honest. You know, I was young and I hadn't really had a career before. And then I played poker for a living. I mean, I was really, you know, and before that, I'd just been a massive pothead and a sort of a washed up club kid. I was such a bad fit. And in amongst those grey suits and those MBAs, we rubbed each other up the wrong way and got in a lot of tussles, which I look back on and I'm sort of slightly embarrassed of. But when I sort of had, you know, I grew out of that, you know, I grew into my career. And now I meet women all the time who have some of those same issues about imposter syndrome. Just at the head of this conversation, Karen said, I'm into business, but oh no, I'm not, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur. And it's just like, I hear that stuff all the time. And so solving problems like that, helping women like you not to say that anymore, to feel like your business is valid, it's almost like going back in time and helping myself, you know, that person, that kid who was quite adrift. You know, we're going to talk about mentors, but I didn't really have a support system. I didn't really have anyone to say, you've made a great idea, you know, this is really a big deal that Waitrose want this. And so it feels very therapeutic for me to be amongst other women passing on the stuff that I actually a lot of the time had to find out for myself. It's kind of, it feels like those very hard learnt lessons that I'm sort of getting more value out of them by passing them forward. It feels great. And also the thing of birthing a baby like on your own at 42, it's quite, you know, we talked about one of the things that was interesting about being a parent and working is that you don't know what kind of a parent you're going to be until you have a kid. I always thought that I'd be like Nicola Horlick, because I love to work. I really love it. And I used to do enormous, you know, for 10, 12, 13 years, I'd work all the hours I was awake and was always really well. I really binged on work. And I thought I'd be like that, you know, have a baby and farm it out and just work, work, work. And I just really wasn't. I turned into some kind of loosey-goosey attachment parenting. My kid still sleeps in my bed. She's 5 and a half. It's like, so that has been an adventure in itself. And I'm attracted to other women, I think, in a different way than I was before. I think, was it Jane Fonda who sort of said, until you're sort of approaching the menopause, all women are competition on a sort of a cellular level. And I feel like, yeah, as I've sort of birthed this baby and my hormone profile is changing, my relationship with my fellow woman is really mellowing and coming into fruition, and I'm there for them, you know. So that's kind of why I would say.
And dare I say it, Fleur, really wise words about the aging process as well, because I think, you know, you as well as me know that our society is particularly ageist, and you've really encapsulated, I think, one of the benefits of getting a little bit older and a little bit more mature. So well done, and thank you for that. That made me feel good, because I'm older than you, by the way. But you mentioned your Grasshopper product, and I can tell that real work is the thing you wish you'd had then. But let's go back to Grasshopper. And what do you really wish you'd known then?
I didn't understand that about basic information about business models. So I didn't know that I was choosing a scale-up business model that wouldn't be in profit for 18 months. And I didn't understand there were startup costs associated with it and that there were different ways of accessing money, planning expenditure. So really basic financial knowledge I didn't have. I just started selling porridge and I thought, oh, at some point, you know, Waitrose will choose us like Simon Cowell and change our lives. It was really like, you know, that we'll be chosen and then suddenly there'll be all this money in the business and we'll suddenly be able to pay ourselves lots of money. I didn't understand that in that business model, you kind of never pay yourself any money. You know, you just pedal like crazy and then occasionally one of these things strikes gold and you make 10 million quid, but most of you just end up skint having had a great time. I mean, that is, I really didn't understand about that, that if I'd gone and invested in a franchise or a fish and chip shop next to the football stadium, you know, that I'd be making the same amount of money every Saturday for the last 10 years, that financially, you know, my life would be very different. Not that I regret that. In fact, I'm a very gambly person by nature. You know, I live very comfortably in the hustle zone. But I felt like I was failing because it wasn't generating lots of money. And so I didn't understand implied odds, as it's called in poker, associated value, the notional value of what I'd created. And unfortunately, that meant that it was easier for people who did know that to remove it from me.
I think it's really interesting what you're saying, also just around support networks, particularly with other women in business, and whether there's a competitiveness there or how women work together. And actually something we've heard a lot from other female founders that we've spoken to is that they have been pleasantly surprised to find that now there are such strong support networks in place with real kindness, people being willing to offer their time and their advice. And it sounds, well, you said you didn't really have any mentor. It sounds like maybe at the time that wasn't accessible for you. So I was wondering who you relied on as your support network at the time.
My dad, really. Can I step back? What's really interesting about what you said there, Karen, is women entrepreneurs reporting back that there's community, support communities with kindness. There's such a fixation with kindness in this, in the world of like women supporting women. It's like the first accusation that women reach for if they want to take down another woman is that they're not kind. You know, it's like at the top of the wish list of what makes us, you know, like when I was young, sort of growing up, there was this sort of divisive thing of whether you're a good girl or not, which basically means had you let a bloke squeeze your boobs or not. Like, you know, that's kind of, you know, literally that was kind of what it is in like regional Britain growing up. You know, And whether you're kind or not, it's like the world is divided into kind women and not kind women. And it's kind of, I feel like it, it deflects us slightly from the matter at hand, which is opening doors, buying services off each other, investing in each other's businesses, and creating the products that other women need in order to live and work more effectively. I just feel like there's a kind of fetishization of kindness. And actually, the problem that you're describing, the cutthroat nature of the entrepreneurial world, isn't caused by a lack of kindness. It's caused by the nature of capitalism and the nature of a limited company. Whereas if I sell you a load of shares in my business, my legal obligation is to deliver financial value to you and not to, you know, and if that's a care home company and I'm looking after old ladies and visiting them in their homes, my obligation is to you kind of before them. So there's structures within capitalism which are causing the problem, not lack of kindness or empathy. I mean, listen, sometimes, of course, there exists sort of these people. Again, another thing that's kind of really fetishized is narcissism. Oh, they're a narcissist. They're a narcissist. You know, this whole kind of thing, which is just a psychological idea. It's a theory. You know, it's not, you can't look in someone's head and it's like, oh, yes, they're a narcissist, yes or no. It's just it's a trend or a fashion. You're like, obviously, there's these characters in business. You know, there's the Philip Greens, you know, these odious people who are fixated on, you know, financial gain at the cost of other human beings. They really exist and they're thriving. But generally, people who I meet who are starting businesses are creative, collaborative, energized, positive, optimistic. Lack of kindness isn't really a problem that I'm coming up against.
So, Flair, you said your dad has been an amazing network. Tell us a bit more about that.
My dad's a dentist. He worked in the NHS for 35 years. What I notice about my dad is that he knows how to live. You know, we're talking about mentors, and I don't always think that what we're lacking is someone to explain industries for us, or make introductions, or say, or to give us, you know, the details of what margins there are in different ways of trading. I feel like for me, the growth and the real mentorship has come by observing people who know how to be happy and know how to live well. And my dad's just got that down. He's just...
I'd love to meet your dad. He sounds like a great guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's going a bit out of date. He still makes some pretty off-key jokes. There's some off-key gags.
Let's go back to Grasshopper again, because you mentioned your lucky break getting into Waitrose. And for a lot of startups or scale-ups, getting into retail is still a bit of a scary thing. And I've never done it. I've had friends who've pitched to Tesco and it sounds terrifying. So when your female entrepreneurs come to you and they're getting ready to pitch to a retailer, what tips have you got for them?
Yes. So the first thing I would say is forget the word pitch, because, you know, these programs like the Dragon's Den and who's that orange fellow who's just left the White House, you know, there's kind of all of that, you're fired, you know, you're out, you know, I choose you. All of that culture has rather filtered down into my part of the world. And people going to pitch, as you say, into retail, feel they take that into the meeting with them. So first of all, I say, change the word, change the way you talk about yourself. And you're going to talk to Tesco's and find out if your product is a fit for them. And if not, why not? So take curiosity into the room. Come with curiosity about who the person is. Do your research like any decent dinner party guest, you know, find out whose house you're going to, what they care about, what they're cooking you. Be curious, ask questions, be polite, say, oh, lovely curtains. What a lovely, huge wind. Aren't you lucky to have so much light there? Seriously, the getting to know you relationship aspect of that meeting is forefront, because you might not end up selling them this range of products, but in 8 years' time, you might have something else for them. So like relationships, learning, curiosity. And also there's a thing around language and lingo and jargon. Like, forget that. Like, relax. It's fine. If they say, oh, you know, what's your blah, blah, blah on this? And you don't know the words they mean, just smile and just say, this is the first time I've done this. I don't know what that means. I remember an example of this when pre-Waitrose, the porridge was just selling in surf shops on the South Coast, in marina shops. And I thought, oh, God, come on, let's go for it. And I just sent some to the to Harvey Nichols Food Hall. And they phoned up and they said, we really like your porridge. We'd like to stock it. Who's your distributor? And I stopped and I said, I don't know what that is, but if you tell me, I'll get one. And she was a nice woman. They're great. They're a great, you know, first store. They love newness. They really invest in small brands. And yeah, so that, just don't be afraid to be a novice. You don't have to be an expert. They're the expert. And if they, you know, they say, oh, this isn't right, say, how can I make it right? You know, what do you think, what are your investors, your customers interested in? What do they want to eat? What do you want to see? What would make you, what if I walk back here in 6 months, what could I bring to you that would just make your problems go away? What would make you happy? Just get the information, get the data. And also the other thing is, it's not just about getting to a yes. It's not just about sort of twisting their arm until they get to a yes, because when you get to a yes, that's just the beginning of your working relationship. So understanding that, you know, you see this sort of nonsense old school negotiating a lot when it's like, oh, you've got to get, you know, get more, you get the best price, get the best price you can. But even if you are clever enough to sort of nobble them on the price, if the price doesn't work for them, they're going to get fed up in the relationship. You're looking to find a solution that works for both of you so that it's stable and it's sustainable and you can partner and move forward together. And some customers are better than others. Waitrose actually was a brilliant customer. I've sold into them twice. They did everything they said they were going to do. They gave me a great price. They gave me great payment terms. I mean, we were absolutely green as grass when we walked in the door, and they could have mugged us so easily, and they didn't. They did the opposite. They really helped our brand and really built us up. They used to do things like do like full page spreads about me and my sister in the Waitrose magazine that goes on the checkout at every Waitrose. Nowadays, like if you got a PR company to negotiate that, I mean, you just pay thousands for that. We didn't even know it was worth thousands. We'd be like, and they'd fix up whole photo shoots for us. And we didn't even know what that was worth. And we'd just turn up and go, oh, thanks so much. And, you know, send a thank you card to the photographer. My sister would like make her a hedgehog cake with chocolate buttons on or something and say, yeah, great, thanks. Didn't even know. People go into that situation and create a dynamic like it's in, you're in mastermind, like what's your specialized subject? Dude, it's just not that. It's a conversation. And even if there's numbers that you should know, and they say, oh, you know, what's your delivery price on this? And you can't remember. You just said, you know, I'm a bit nervous. I slipped my mind. I'll put it on an email. I'm excited to be here. Or it's been a long drive. I just can't. I don't have that number. I'll get it to you. And also, if you're really in a situation where you're really stuck, like anyone, however like relaxed we are about ourselves and however comfortable we are in our own skin, we can all be in situations when we feel like a cat on a fence with our back arched. I'm like, we all have that, you know, when we just can't speak, it's just not working. And I just see that again as get the data, get the information. I've had that with a buyer. And as soon as I walked in, he was just a very aggressive, angry guy who got out of the bed the wrong side. I was with a colleague. He found out that she'd worked in a place that was in competition to them. And he asked her to leave the meeting. It was completely over the top sort of macho behavior. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, I mean, we've crashed and burned in the worst possible way before we've even started. So then I just thought, well, we've got nothing to lose. So you know, like that thing, Crazy Horse, that Native American. It's just like, if you believe you're not going to die, it's the most, you know, effective way to go into battle. And I just thought, well, we've lost the listing in the first minute, so I'll just see what I can do with this guy who's the most disagreeable person I've met in a few years, and just sort of practiced my fluffing up skills on him. And, you know, it's sometimes there's just, but I don't want to work with someone like that. It's just, even if I'd got him to say yes, you know, I kind of got him to a yes, but I just, you know, there's other customers are available, and you actually have to have that. The whole point of having your own business is that you don't have to be around people you hate, right? That's the whole point. Otherwise, just go and get a job in a company and work for David Brent bossing you around the whole time if you want to take a day in lieu to go to your kid's ballet lesson. It's like, oh God. So I don't want to be around people like that. This just, life's too short.
Interesting what you've been saying also, Fleur, around how we behave in those pitch situations. Something we've also heard, we recently spoke to the female founders of Double Dutch and Fitbakes, and Ellen, the founder of Fitbakes, said that she had had feedback, or at least heard anecdotally, that there's a real perception that women pitching for investment can be too emotional, focusing too much on things like founder stories. I wondered what your perspective on that was.
I'm going to sound really woke. I would say that's victim blaming. I think the problem with women in investment isn't that the women's pitches aren't good enough, or that they're too emotional, that they're too eggy. I would say that the problem is, you know, societal lack of belief in female founders, and just a whole load of tropes about them. You know, I mean, even sort of saying, oh, women too emotional in that situation. I mean, I just feel like the whole language around that is just, it's just not that clever. Do you know what I mean? I feel like there's lots of rich people around. Most of them are men. And there's lots of really capable, really bright women solving problems with businesses. And it's, you know, we're all just busy at grassroots level trying to break down some of the language and some of the systems that exist so that the money can just be spread out in a slightly more even way. And we can get money into businesses with women driving.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like quite unfair feedback.
Yeah.
And it's so is it, I guess it's fair to say that you've encountered some pretty misogynistic men in your experiences. What do we need to do to make that more inclusive, or what needs to happen for men like that to be more inclusive?
For me, I don't like to sort of band groups of individuals together and sort of say, you know, you're a misogynist or you're a narcissist or you're, people are just people, aren't they? You know, and sometimes I'm misogynistic, right? I've said things, I've made jokes or like looked down on other women in ways that could be described as misogyny. So I feel like, you know, I believe in people, and I really like men. I'm really lucky. I've got a dad who's just the best of them. So I'm not on a mission in that way. And equally, actually, if I'm honest, when I look at structural institutional sexism and institutional bias, I don't really understand it all. I'm not, you know, the data and who's getting the data on this and how change will affect it. That's kind of not my area of genius in a way, but I really like people. And I really hope that my sincerity around empowering women and the businesses that I come across to be more inclusive and to be more humane, if you like, I feel that it's powerful. I feel that it's working. And I feel like that's kind of my area, and I can take responsibility for the relationships that I have and the people who I affect. there's a lot of other people who are really good at analyzing systems and macro things. I'm very grassroots. So I wish I had an answer for you, a clever answer, and then we could clip it and we could use it to advertise this podcast and I'd look so clever and everyone would come and hire me to do a TED talk, and not just a regional one, a TED talk, you know, probably in America, maybe, you know, with some really famous people. But yeah, I don't have those answers. I have the smaller answers for one-to-one people.
I've got a hypothesis for you, changing the subject slightly, and it's based on a few anecdotal incidents of what I'm about to tell you. And I alluded to this earlier. I've had a few friends who have either been furloughed or part furloughed, or have found themselves with more time on their hands. And those friends have become quite entrepreneurial. These are ones who have got corporate jobs, you know, working for a PLC or a big brand. And something about furlough or time at home, time with family, has made them reevaluate. Obviously, we will see in a year's time if my theory is right and all of those sprouting businesses have actually come to life. But, and by the way, a lot of our listeners are members of the Marketing Society, and it's that kind of community that I'm referring to. So if somebody is germinating their business idea, would you encourage them to go on with it?
Of course I would. And I would, the first thing I would say is it doesn't even matter how far you get with it or how far you grow it. It's still valid. It still matters. And I would say, be curious. What is it about that project that is interesting? It doesn't mean that you have to dive out of your job. You know, if you've got mouths to feed and you've got a mortgage to pay and you know, you're pretty happy in your job, it doesn't mean you have to quit your job. Maybe you can change the way you work. You know, you can learn things from what you've been dabbling in and say, why was that fun for me? Why was that interesting? What do I observe about myself from that? You know, what did I get out of that? How did it pay me? You know, and some of those things can carry over into other areas of our lives. I'm really curious. And when I collaborate with people, it can feel like micromanagement. I have to kind of explain it at the beginning. Like, I, you know, want to learn about what headphones you've got and like when you first started about podcasting and how you know, what ground rules you have about how you co-host together. Like, I think about those things a lot. And so I like any work that I'm doing, I need to sort of build that in order to be happy. So I think you can learn what's making you happy from a side hustle. I think that for me, what I've observed in side hustlers in the pandemic is that it's been a response to the insecurity generated by institutions that we thought would go on forever, sinking into administration, you know, the dissolution of the high street monolith, you know, really businesses that have been around in all of our living memories that have gone bust, we've not thought they could never go bust. And there's a big sense of uncertainty about that. Brexit, you know, taking out, you know, chunks of the city that's just going to go, you know, to France or Madrid. I think it's the business equivalent of sort of getting a rucksack and getting into orienteering and learning to make a fire, knowing that if push came to shove, you could grab a rucksack and keep your family alive. I do feel it's like that, because it's, you know, the subconscious tremors that we're all experiencing. My neighbor went to hospital in an ambulance yesterday. He's like 35-year-old healthy guy. It's like, that affects us. It's affecting us. And seeing businesses and disappear, there's no job for life. You know, we were always told that, but now we know that, we see that. And I feel like the side hustle has fulfilled so many functions in reassuring us, making us feel capable, you know, making us mentally agile, loads of things. It's a great idea.
So, Fleur, we have let you know that our signature question about their favourite TV ads, and you had some, well, for what some people might be some very memorable picks. So tell us a bit about the ads you've chosen. If you can explain them a bit and why you've chosen them.
I should say that I was born in 1973. So what was kind of memorable for my era about ads was that because there wasn't many TV channels, we were all watching the same ads in the 80s. So unfortunately, they downloaded into about, they probably occupied about 10% of my brain for quite a long time during the 80s. And I went on Instagram before I came onto this podcast and I said, oh, there's this question. And what do you remember? And God, everyone remembers everything. Ice Magic, Bran Flakes, you know, Shake and Vac, you know, it's all. And I remember I could sing all of the songs of all of them. But it's fairly traumatic to do that. And well, the ones that really stick in my mind as having the most impact were actually the terrifying ones, which were, what would you call them? Like the public health advertisements, the ones.
I think we called them public information films. Fleur. Yeah.
Public information films. And so ad agencies made them, did they?
They did, but the
they
one you're
about. Commissioned by the government.
Yeah, latterly, yeah.
So Charlie Says was the one. And I think it was the same illustrator who, the same cartoonist that made my favourite cartoon when I was little, Mary, Mungo and Midge. And so I felt like it was something familiar and then it became terrifying when they were kind of abducted or something. And there was one, don't go back to a lit firework when the kids' fingers get blown off. And at the end of it, they hold up a glove and there's two fingers missing. Another one when... God, this is, why was this normal then? That's why I'm laughing. If that was on the telly now, I'd be like, oh, let's have a big discussion about how we feel about this. But my mum would just be off in her flares doing whatever she was doing. She just, while we were watching this stuff. The other ones were Charlie says there's an electricity pylon when the kid gets electrocuted through a kite. I'm very afraid of all these things still. I'm genuinely afraid of railway lines, electricity pylons, drowning. There was a drowning one.
One day when my dad went fishing, he took Charlie and me along. Charlie tried to do an extra big jump and he went over the edge and into the water. Charlie nearly drowned. It was very lucky for him, he caught on the line. Charlie says next time we go fishing, we should stay very close to Dad where he can look after us. And he hopes that when you go near the water, you'll stay close to a grown-up too.
The reason I thought of them is because of thinking about how the government is talking to us now in the pandemic versus how they used to now, because there was a very parental tone then. It was always like a very serious man almost telling us off, wasn't it, then? Whereas now the government information is much kinder. And of course, in the 80s, the sort of denouement of that genre, which was, you know, quite life-changing, was the tombstone, the Don't Die of Ignorance. I mean, that was extraordinary when you look back on John Hurt. I wonder what John Hurt thinks of that advert now. Because it hasn't aged well, I don't think. Apparently, Margaret Thatcher said that if you actually talked about men having sex on the advert, it would inspire men to go and have sex with each other, even if they hadn't before.
We'll put the link to the Charlie Says, that's what they're called, public information films. They're actually made in 1973, Fleur, so the year you were born, but you're right.
Born, they started, but they went on for ages,
they
didn't
did.
They?
Yeah, they ran well on into the 80s. There were a total of six films made. They were made by what was then called the Central Office of Information, which, as you said, sounds rather Orwellian, doesn't
Who
it?
Who is that? Who is
they
that?
They don't exist anymore, but it was, I guess it was the more liberal version of the Department for Misinformation back in the war or something
like that.
Do you
think it was like on that floor in John Malkovich's head, yes. The halfway floor?
9 3/4 or something. Or yeah. Is that the platform where you get
Harry Potter. No, something
you
like
know
that.
What I mean. fascinating. But the history of it, in 1991, the Prodigy sampled it. You knew that. You
they
were going to tell me about that, weren't you?
And the fact that song was such a hit was because that was so deep in our minds. That was like, for my generation, that was just an old friend. Charlie was an old friend.
Yeah.
He got a fish at the end.
And in 2006, they were voted the UK's favourite public information films by viewers of BBC News. And in 2014, they were remade.
Hang on.
Electrical safety films. Come on, what did you want to say?
Favourite information films. As we've just demonstrated, though, the field is rather thin. I mean, you just had the ones. It was Charlie, the friendly cat, was up against the kids getting a mutilated hand, the kid getting electrocuted, the railway tracks, and the clunk click of Jimmy Savile, prolific, criminal. Making sure kids are safe. So I feel like it was a clear winner.
It was a shoo-in.
Sure, what's your thing?
In 2014, the voice of the cat, who was the voice of the cat in the original films?
Dear Kenny Everett.
Kenny Everett was the voiceover. In 2014, obviously Kenny no longer with us, David Walliams took over and did a series of electrical safety films. Sadly, we've run out of time, Fleur, but I mean, thank you so much. On many levels...
We're heading to YouTube for those.
Yes, everybody will be heading to YouTube
now for those.
Thank you on many levels. Thank you for letting us share those films that I'd forgotten about, but I've been...
Watch those. The new ones, the updated ones only. Don't watch the old ones. You'll have nightmares. You actually will have nightmares.
I think they're a really interesting view into the window of history back in the 70s.
Definitely.
I think we should definitely look at them. So, yeah, great.
How we would say that differently. Because the thing is, you see, I don't have the answer. How would we do it differently? They're difficult things to talk about to kids and, to young people. So it's not like you can look back and say, oh, they're rubbish. You know, they're not great, but...
And I bet if our listeners could talk to you, they'd say thanks for the tips, genuinely. There's some really insightful stuff there.
Oh, that's
and
sweet.
From me, and I said this earlier, you've been inspiring in terms of how authenticity can be so powerful. So thank you for that as well.
It's been
absolutely. I've really enjoyed that as well. I really enjoy your perspective on how things, well, not how things work, but how to be more yourself, I guess. And that's been really interesting to listen to. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll hopefully see you again soon, Fleur. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.